I'm Leonard Lope. Welcome back to my show, and we want to welcome back the listeners to WNYC AM 820 who have been following live gavel-to-gavel coverage of the confirmation hearings for Supreme Court nominee Samuel A. Alito. We'll return to that when the hearings resume. Temple Grandin has been credited with revolutionizing animal movement systems, and she has a doctorate in animal behavior. But the fact that she's autistic may have given her unique insights into how animals think. Temple Grandin was last here to talk about her best-selling book, Animals in Translation. We very rarely invite guests back for the paperback edition, but we wanted to check in with her on any developments since its original publication. It is always a treat for me to speak to her as well, so welcome back.
Well, it's good to be here.
How extensive a publicity tour did you have for the hardcover edition of Animals in Translation?
Well, I was 2 weeks on the road, and I've got another 2.5 weeks to go all over the country for the paperback edition.
What kinds of groups were you meeting with and speaking with? Are most of the people interested in the autism aspect of the story or of the animals aspect?
Well,
at
the bookstores, it kind of depends upon how the publicity has gone. There's some bookstores where it's almost totally an autism crowd. Last night, we had a lot of it was a real mixture of a half and half. It just kind of depends upon where the publicity goes. I did one thing up in one bookstore, the whole thing was animals. Another one, it was almost all autism people.
What has been the response from people with autism and their family members to the suggestion that there are links between the way autistics think and the way animals think?
Well, I've been asked that question before, and there's a lot of good things that animals do. They don't get into the terrible wars that people get into. Some of the meanest, most vicious stuff gets done by people, and most animals are not doing those kind of things. But the main thing that makes them similar is getting away from language. See, when I think, I use pictures. If I think about something new, pictures come into my mind, and language narrates the pictures. That's one of the main things that's similar.
Were you aware of that when you were young, or is this something that eventually occurred to you when you realized that you weren't reacting to things the way others did?
When I was a little kid, I thought everybody thought in pictures. When I was in high school, I thought everybody thought in pictures. I didn't know that my thinking was different. My very first inkling that my thinking was different was when I read an article in college in one of the news magazines that the caveman would have had language in order to develop tools. And I thought that was absolutely ridiculous. You know, then I started reading some of the philosophical things about thinking. And then when I did my earlier book, Thinking in Pictures, I started interviewing people about how they think. And I had a standard question I asked them, and it was, access your memory on church steeples. And most people, when I ask them that question, they get a vague kind of generalized church steeple. I only see specific ones. And then I have to take those specific images, group those together into a category to understand the concept of what a church steeple is. And some very verbal people, and these are rare, have no picture at all. But that's extremely rare.
So they're the total opposite of you, those people who don't even imagine some kind of a pointy thing when you say church steeple.
That's right. And some people imagine a very vague stick-like figure of the church steeple. Other people get a much more detailed, you know, New England church kind of thing. There's degrees of visual thinking. And then I have visual thinking where when I draw a drawing, I can actually do full motion video in my head and make it move.
So that means that you have to translate your ideas into language. Is that something you had to teach yourself to do?
Well, as I got older, I got better and better and better. My mind works like Google for images. You know, when I was real young, it was like when the internet first started, and there's just not very many pictures in there. As I put more and more information on the hard drive, then I can put it into more and more and more, things I can associate together.
And you've changed in the time that I've known you, because I remember when you first came here to talk about thinking in pictures, and it was harder for you. You still felt a little anxious about doing the book tour, and now you seem so totally at ease.
Well, you keep learning. It's like the more information I put on my hard drive, the more information that the Google that's inside my head can bring up and associate together. You know, the more information that's there, the better I can think.
What led you to see links between the way you think and the way that animals think?
Well, I've done a lot of study of neuroscience, and animals do not have verbal language. And the only way, other way that they could possibly think would be in visual images, in smells, in sounds. Think about how much information the dog gets when he goes to the local hydrant. He knows who's been there, when they were there, what is their rank, are they a friend or a foe, and are there any females around to breed?
Mm-hmm. And we don't have that kind of stuff available to us. I mean, to most of us anyway, because their noses are so much more subtle than ours. But you're saying that they're not only thinking in pictures,
they're thinking in smells. They are thinking in smells.
And sounds as well, because a dog can hear all sorts of things that the rest of us can't. They'll hear somebody coming up the stairs when the rest of us won't hear them until they ring the doorbell.
Well, it's thinking without language. And there's been some interesting research now with Alzheimer's patients. There's a certain type of frontal temporal lobe dementia where the person loses language and loses functions in the frontal cortex, and art and music talent will come out of somebody that had no previous interest in art or music. And that's been published in the journal Neurology. That's a really good scientific article.
Has anyone come up with a physiological explanation for how the brains of autistic people develop?
Yes, there's actually a lot known about that, and I get a little bit frustrated when people say they know nothing about this. Margaret Bowman, I don't know, over 15 years ago, did autopsy research that showed that the emotion centers of the brain and the cerebellum that's involved with integrating different brain systems is immature and underdeveloped. Eric Korshain's much more recent research is showing there's abnormalities in the white matter in the brain. You see, in your brain, you got gray matter, that's a computer processor. White matter are the computer cables that connect up the different departments in the brain, like connecting up different departments in an office building. And in the autistic brain, these interdepartmental connections are abnormal. You know, maybe you get a whole lot of wiring in the graphic design department or the math department. Other things don't get wired up. And this would account for the extreme variability in autism.
Now, we don't understand why that happens. But when we're young, these dendrites start making connections, and they make them differently in different people. But there are certain basic patterns that occur in everyone. They don't occur in autistic
people. Well, in autism, the brain's basic memory store, the back third in the visual cortex, that tends to be normal. And the greatest abnormality with these white matter computer cables is in the frontal cortex. And autistic brains are specialized. You know, I'm a visual thinker, but there's other people, they're a music and math pattern thinker, and others are kind of a language translator thinker.
Most autistic people are just people who find it very hard to communicate.
Well, you see,
something is going on in their brains.
Well, autism is very variable, from somebody that remains nonverbal all the way up to somebody like Einstein. And one of the things that happens is some of the social circuits don't get hooked up. But think about it. The really social people didn't make the first stone spear, after all. We wouldn't have any radio station here if you didn't have some Asperger or mildly autistic people to run all the engineering.
My guest is Temple Grandin, who has, with the help of Katherine Johnson, written her latest book, a bestseller called Animals in Translation, now being published in paperback by Harcourt. This is WNYC, AM and FM. You dropped Einstein's name there. So you feel that Einstein was autistic?
He would have probably been diagnosed autistic today because he had no language until age 3. Simon Baron Cohen over in England has been researching physicists. There's a book out called Asperger's and Self-Esteem. It's about famous scientists and musicians, people like Carl Sagan and Mozart, that would have probably been Asperger's, which is the milder variant where there's no obvious speech delay.
Well, there are disagreements as to whether Asperger's is autism or the mirror to autism. But in the end, what they have in common is certain socializing
problems. That's right.
Problems.
Certain socializing problems, but a lot of the Asperger people are very intelligent.
Now, what about that affinity with animals? You actually went into the field. Is this something that you discovered very early in your life? Did you have a lot of pets when you were a kid?
No, when I was a kid, I had we had a golden retriever. But my big interest started with high school with horses. When I got in, I went really big into horses, into showing horses, and then the cattle interest got started when I visited my aunt's ranch.
And there are people who feel that. That one way to treat autism is to connect the children with animals, horseback riding. There's even some people who connect the kids with dolphins.
Well, some of these programs are very helpful. One thing with the horseback riding, you get the rhythm stimulation, and that's very good for the child's brain. And then some people have been have success with service dog, Labrador Retriever trained. See, one thing about a dog is, or a dolphin, it keeps wanting to interact. And one of the really important things with young autistic children is it's really important to get them to interact. Interact with the teacher. You know, there's all kinds of controversy about whether it should be ABA or floor time and all the different programs. The most important thing is plenty of hours with a really excellent teacher. And some teachers have that knack on just how to be gently insistent to kind of pull the child out of it.
And if you're picking a pet, it should be a pet that interacts a lot.
Yeah, and you'd want, I think, a big dog, so if the child grabs it too hard, it isn't going to hurt it. It's the big friendly dog that wants to interact would probably be the best thing. And the thing is, some autistic children may respond really well to the dog, others don't. Autism, I can't emphasize enough how variable autism is.
In fact, there are no basic rules, but there are a number of things that can be looked for. And if 10 out of 12 are present, or 8 out of 12, there's a good chance that we're talking about autism.
Yes, and every expert will agree that you need to start an educational program the instant you see the abnormal behavior, the lack of speech, the no social contact, rocking, with many, many hours a week, with structured interaction and activities with a really good teacher.
Many autistic people avoid direct eye contact and look at others almost peripherally. Is this something that animals do as well?
Well, you see, in animals, staring down, that's a predatory stare. But another problem with eye contact is sensory. I cannot multitask. And when I go look at the person's eyes, that was so distracting that I had problems with hearing what the person was saying. You know, my sensory problems are relatively mild. I have problems with sound sensitivity and scratchy clothes. But there's other people with more severe sensory problems where they're monochannel, and they're not able to see and hear at the same time. They've either got to look at something or they've got to hear something, but they can't do both.
This is an awareness of detail as opposed to the big picture that you've written a lot about.
Well, you see, if you're thinking in detailed visual images, you're going to think in detail. You know, it's just like teaching a guide dog for the blind what an intersection is. If you just taught him on an intersection that had a white painted crosswalk, the dog wouldn't know what to do on one with no crosswalk. So in order for the dog's brain to understand that concept, you got to show him many, many different types of intersections with different markings, different curbs, and different lights. Then when you take him to a strange city, he's going to know what to do. Now, with a severely autistic child, you have to do exactly the same thing. You have to teach him not to run across the street in many, many, many different places.
When we train animals, we often train them through some kind of behavioral approach. When you went to college, B.F. Skinner's behaviorism was very popular. You had objections to it.
Well, I was lucky enough when I was in college to take a very good animal ethology class, a classical animal ethology class from a professor named Tom Evans. And he was a reptile specialist. And he worked on a lot of the instinctual behavior patterns of birds and reptiles. And it was very obvious in taking his class that operant conditioning doesn't explain everything. It explains a lot of things, but not everything. And I remember having a conversation with B.F. Skinner, and I said, if we could only learn about the brain. And he says, we don't need to learn about the brain. We have operant conditioning. Well, I never could buy that. Operant conditioning is very, very important. But it doesn't explain everything. And animals really can think, and thinking is defined as solving a problem under novel conditions.
When you wrote this book, you were talking about some things that were just in the experimental phase. Have there been developments since in the past year or so?
Well, on the animal cognition, they've been further working on that. There was the experiments done in Science and Nature, where a crow figured out how to bend a piece of paperclip wire to snag a snack out of a little tube.
So crows are now discovered, it's now been discovered that crows can now create tools?
Yes.
Because there was a recent development where they discovered an ape, I think it was a gorilla, who used a stick to figure out the depth of a river, which was pretty incredible.
Yeah,
that's
that
real.
Is.
These are the sorts of things that people said animals could never do.
Well, they're finding, that birds such as crows and blue jays can do a lot of things. There's another experiment famous, you know, unique experiment where a blue jay was hiding little worm treats in an ice cube tray in different compartments with sawdust in them. And if the other jay was watching, he would wait till the other jay wasn't watching, and then he'd hide it in a different place because he knew the other jay would rip it off.
Temple Grandin's book, Animals in Translation, a national bestseller in hardcover, is now available in paperback from Harcourt. Using the Mysteries of Autism to Decode Animal Behavior is its subtitle, written with the help of Katherine Johnson. And as always, it's been a great pleasure talking with you today.
It's been great to be here.